Buongiorno.
Cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war.
Is that one of the lines from the movie?
Yeah, it was in the movie.
When he was doing his Shakespearean?
Yeah, just one of the times. Because he didn't do it very often. It was you had to, you know, really pay attention, otherwise you might miss it.
Yeah,
So, Dan, let's just get this out of the way right up here at the front before we even have any fun or talk about anything exciting or even a misdirect into another topic. I've been trying to coerce you for over a year, 2 years. I don't know. I forget the last time we did a Star Trek was Star Trek 5. I've been trying to coerce you into doing Star Trek 6.
We watched Star Trek 5?
Yes.
What happened in that one?
That was the one that William Shatner directed, where they go find God in the space barrier. And he says, what does God need with a starship? And all that jazz. And Spock has a half-brother.
Spock has a half-brother?
I honestly can't tell how much of this you're kidding about.
No, I'm not kidding. God, the God Cloud sounds familiar, but I don't remember Spock's half-brother.
Okay. Yeah, I have made you watch 2, 3, 4, and 5. And I took pity on you, and I'm not going to make you watch the first one. And every time I mention that I'm not going to make you watch the first one because it's so dull and so boring and so long... You for some reason you always like perk up at the thought of that. You're just like, oh well, maybe Joe's wrong about that. Maybe it's a reverse psychology thing or something. Like as if I would, you know, try to keep the good movie from you.
I just wonder how that could possibly be in light of the fact that this movie is incredibly dull.
Oh, ouch, Dan.
Am I harming you personally?
This is the first Star Trek movie that I saw in a movie theater. My dad and stepmother at the time took us to go see it, and I loved this movie. I had a AMT model Kronos 1 Klingon battlecruiser kit that you put together with the glue. The cells never lined up on that one, but you know it's always tricky with those things. Never painted it, and then you know I really liked it. It's one of my favorites. I would rent it from Blockbuster all the time. And they had this really annoying Paramount feature presentation music and stuff that would come on at the beginning. And it was all cropped down to 4:3. And you kind of lose some of the magic of it, I think, on a 4:3, 21-inch television. Not that... I think you will feel that there is magic to be had on your 16:9, whatever inch TV that you're watching. I really always liked it. You're not gonna agree with this at all, but I even like the boring credits at the beginning, because I love
the 3.5 minute long text on screen.
Yes. With gradients. I really like Cliff Eidelman's score for this. It is unusual and not very Star Trek-y, but also very bombastic in a Star Trek-y kind of way. So it's Star Trek without being Star Trek. Like, he's not doing an impersonation of James Horner or Jerry Goldsmith or anybody else, really. So it was interesting. And sometimes when I'm driving in traffic, I'll listen to Battle for Peace, because it is a bop. I love it. I also get it, Bob, because it's a bird of prey. But we will get to the specifics of the plot later.
First of all, you've had entirely too much sugar today. And you're going to make me feel bad because I can't just shit all over this movie because you've already tied it into your youth and your identity and your family and things. And, That makes it harder to tell you that you're wrong about stuff.
Yes. Well, you know what? You just have to shut up.
thing that I will say is that if this was the first Star Trek movie you saw, I understand how you would enjoy that. This is a for 1991. Mm-hmm. This feels like a very above average episode of a TV show that you could go see in a movie theater. Now watching it, I don't know why this had to be a movie, but I guess they needed. I briefly looked at Wikipedia and they're like, we're going to do a prequel. And then everyone hated it. And they're like, oh, never mind. We're not going to do a prequel. We'll do the old people retiring. And then they slapped this together. But if this was your introduction to Star Trek cinema, like, yeah, that makes sense. But you can't put this up there with like Wrath of Khan stuff, can you?
No. Well, see, I said this is not my introduction to Star Trek cinema, as you put it. It's a little lofty. This is my first time seeing Star Trek on the big screen, but well,
that's why I said cinema, because cinema is only in the big screen.
Oh, okay. Okay, Quentin. But I had seen all of the Star Trek movies on VHS for the most part by this point before I saw this one, and I know what you mean when you say that it feels like a slightly larger budget TV movie kind of a feeling. I don't think it's because of the way it is shot or edited, but the TV-esque personalities of the people involved in acting and performing some of these roles is definitely there. And also,
and just the convoluted plot line, how they spend like 40 minutes talking about shoes, basically.
Well, I didn't find that convoluted. I thought it was pretty engaging because it's kind of a mystery that you're unraveling.
Right. But it's a mystery in like a Twilight Zone sense. It's not like it's not drama on a feature film level the way some of the things could be. I don't know.
I mean, I guess. Maybe
it seems like TV stakes.
Well, the stakes are whether or not peace goes through, Dan, in the galaxy. That's what the stakes of those boots are.
The stakes are whether or not they get to the meeting where they can talk about potentially having peace going forward.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then he can say, oh, you reinstilled our faith in the future. And then he'll say, no, you reinstated my faith. And then everyone will clap.
Yeah, can you believe everybody just had those off-the-cuff lines? just ready to go off the top of their heads.
And I, Captain Kirk, would like to say, most of all, that I have always appreciated all of your great efforts, and you are truly one of a kind, and I would like to give you a standing ovation out of nowhere.
Yeah, well, but what I was going to say is something that definitely, I think, makes it feel cheap, especially if you are a fan of Star Trek, is the heavy reuse of other sets and props and things, and also the slight modification of other things that are not Star Trek props into being on Star Trek, like the metal detector that you see sweeping a hallway at one point when they're looking for boots. And you also have things like paint coming off of surfaces or things that are not drilled straight if you're looking at certain parts of the paneling that are behind the actors, because a lot of this is done by Herman Zimmerman, who was the Star Trek production designer for Star Trek The Next Generation. So it was like TV scale problem solving for budgets. And when you try to apply that to a film, which they were obligated to do by the way that these kinds of Star Trek movies are financed, basically Paramount says, we will give you $10, go make a movie, and go make a Star Trek. And that's because they have some formula where they're like, if we put in this much money, we're only going to get this much from people going to go see it if it's any good. So there's sort of like a maximum cap. And then they're like, well, how much can we profit off of that if we make it for less than that? And that's why everything always looks so incredibly cheap. And the problem with that, I think, is mainly in here. You see a lot of stuff that fans of Star Trek The Next Generation would identify quickly as being reused, like the sets, which were reused from Star Trek motion pictures, but it had been repainted to be used on the everyday TV show that people would be watching at the time. And also things like the 10 Forward set, which were turned into the president's weird office, where there's like sheer curtains in front of his like 1980s hotel lobby looking room with the and I assume that's there to hide the fact that the Eiffel Tower why am I blanking on the word the Eiffel Tower thing back there is probably not that, it doesn't hold that up that well, but yeah, it's just you see all the cheapness, especially whenever they get close to anything, that it all just, it looks very, very inexpensive, which is kind of a bummer.
Yeah. And to be fair, since I don't care about Star Trek, I don't really notice that stuff until, of course, we get to that scene that you pointed out, the searching scene where the camera gets way too close to everything.
Yeah, like
they should not have done that.
No, because you can see the inside of those drawers is just like some 2x4s that they painted gray. You can like literally see the wood grain from the lights hitting it. It's bad. And when she goes to put the boot on the locker door is wood. And when they go to stick it onto the door, they'd already done several takes of it. So the adhesive had pulled off some of the paint on the door. So when she closes it, there is a mark for where the shoe will eventually land. And that's disappointing to me, because you could obviously see that. I don't know why they would deceive themselves into thinking otherwise. Maybe with the bright set lighting, it didn't occur to anyone that you could see all the little marks, but you definitely can.
Well, they were just assuming everyone would be so engaged by the drama of the story that there would be no need for that.
Yeah, well, I like the drama of the story because it has a little bit of the intrigue. if you're a kid, I will say that the twists and turns are probably more substantial than if you're watching this film as an adult, where it may seem more obvious where the twists and the turns are.
Well, the other thing is they're just kind of inventing things, and I suppose as a more naive viewer, you would just sort of buy into some of that. But they're like, we've never seen anything like this, and we have no evidence of it, but it must be a bird of prey that can shoot while cloaking, even though that's never a thing that's ever been in existence before. We're just going to assume that that's got to be the thing, because it can't be anything else, because we couldn't come up with anything else. Right? We'll survey the room. No, we're good. That's got to be it.
I mean, he says, you know, as an ancestor of his once said, it's a Sherlock Holmes joke. But yeah, what did you think of the humor in this movie then, if you didn't care for the twists and turns or the stakes?
You know, there were references. I guess that it was supposed to be funny that he did the Nixon thing and then the Sherlock Holmes thing, and what were other funny parts?
did you like when Kirk kicked the guy in the knees and then Martius says those weren't his knees?
As soon as he kicked him, I'm like, and he started crouching over, I was like, this guy got balls on his knees or what? And then 2 minutes later,
he has balls on his knees.
He has balls on his knees, which, you know, for walking into coffee tables and stuff, like, that's just a real bad place to keep those, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. None of that was interesting to you.
I don't know. It was weird. I mean, you got Shatner doing his Shatner thing. Like, he's very dramatic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think this movie like needs him to be that guy to make this whole, because like this whole like TV grade plot of like, oh no, somebody sabotaged and killed the head of the bad guys to make it look like the good guys hate the bad guys, but we're really on the same side, it was sabotaged the whole time, like that plot line is very not interesting unless you have somebody as dramatic as Kirk in there, like amping everybody up and talking about his dead Goldilocks son and how he'll never trust a Klingon or whatever. So I appreciated what he was doing most of the time, except when he does quiet Kirk, in which I have to turn the volume up like three times as loud to hear what the hell he's saying, and then something explodes, and then it deafens me.
What did you think of his comedy acting?
Oh, when he was on the prison planet, and he was being Kirk with eyebrows kind of guy.
Yeah. Or and when he has to act out on split screen, can't believe I kissed you. Must have been your lifelong ambition. Like did that? Nothing.
I was amused by that because I was like, look at him poking a little fun at himself, being narcissistic and stuff. But you know, along with you know, knee balls, it's all pretty, you know, first joke that came to mind kind of stuff. But
yeah, okay. And
is this movie fan service? I can't tell if it's fan service because I'm so far removed from it. Like, it seems like they're doing stuff that, like, you know, the winks and the nods with Spock and Kirk are like, oh, look at us, we're doing stuff.
No, because I think it would have been fan service had they been highlighting very specific things to call back to over and over and over again. Whereas it's just a relationship that has existed between these two friends over a long period of time. So if this had been the first Star Trek you were watching, I don't think you would miss out on knowing any of that.
I mean, they didn't even get to hang out that much in this movie. It's probably on purpose, wasn't it?
I don't know. Because the thing was that Shatner's directing was such a bomb on Star Trek V. Because like I mentioned, there's like that, you know, you put a certain amount of money in, you get a certain amount of money out. Well, Shatner broke that. They put a lot of money in, they got very little money out. And so that didn't go over well with people at Paramount. And so they wanted to go back to having Nimoy direct because he did 3 and 4, and those were successes. The 4 being like the biggest success. But they couldn't have Nimoy come back in after Shatner and do a better job than Shatner, because that would have been a problem. So instead, they go to...
Even if this was like already predisposed to be their last rodeo together?
Yeah, I think so. So, and like you mentioned, there's the Harv Bennett thing where he wanted to do Starfleet Academy, where it would have been casting younger actors in these roles of how they first got to meet up and all this other stuff. And that would go on to be basically what J.J. Abrams did many, many years later. Not just J.J., but... the cohorts that he had writing that, who actually cared a little bit more than JJ did. When that was rejected and it was up to, you know, Leonard Nimoy, Ralph Winter, and some other guys to sort of steer where this was going to go, they pitched Nicholas Meyer on coming back because Nicholas Meyer had directed and written Star Trek II, the most popular of these. Not the most popular, but a beloved Star Trek feature episode thing, because while 4 is a big fan favorite and stuff, it's all taking place in the 80s. So it's sort of operating in its own different liminal space. And while Nicholas Meyer had written some of 4, writing all the stuff that happened in the 80s, he didn't take on the whole project. So they wanted to have him come back as a director. They wanted his input on the writing, and they wanted him to do this stuff. And he's like, I don't know. And they twisted his arm into doing it, and they let him have all of these sort of things that he wanted to have, the eccentricities that Nicholas Meyer is prone to, like Shakespeare, because if you remember...
Shakespeare's an eccentricity for him?
Yeah, I remember in Star Trek II, Khan is quoting a lot of Shakespeare too.
Yeah.
That is a
and
thing.
And in turn, you and Todd quoted it at me.
Yeah, and... In Star Trek II, he wanted to call it Star Trek II, The Undiscovered Country, instead of Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, and he was denied that. So this time, he got what he wanted, and it's called Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country.
Well, that explains why the title is crowbarred in here, because it's unnecessary and doesn't make any sense.
He just loves it. He loves talking about the future as the undiscovered country. He thinks it's so poetic, but then it loses some of its poeticness when you're just sort of cribbing a lot of the stuff like as quotations, so it doesn't tie in as well as I think he thought it did.
Yeah, you got a funny looking dude quoting Shakespeare, and you've got an undiscovered country metaphor,
and you also had Nicholas Meyer doing things the way he would like them to be done for the most part, where The set design is a little more militaristic. Everything has a bunch of labels everywhere. And the floors are no longer carpet like they were in the previous ones.
I saw some nice sort of rubberized diamond plate floor when Sulu's tea fell over.
Yep, and also when Chekhov is scanning Klingon Pepto-Bismol off of the transporter pad floor.
Is that what they use for the blood?
I don't think it is literally what they use, but it is very reminiscent of Pepto-Bismol. But they, he got some of what he wanted out of this stuff. And speaking of people getting what they wanted, Sulu didn't want to work with Shatner, because Shatner is awful, as is well documented. George Takei is not exactly, like, I guess, a saint or anything, but he was, you know, through, done with it over Shatner. And they worked out this thing where he's going to be the captain of the Excelsior, and he can sort of bookend this, and it can play into some of the themes of people going on to do other stuff and not just all hanging out on a ship being really old together. So that is something that is there for fans to still see Sulu, but to also for George Takei not to have to endure being around Shatner. And Nicholas Meyer wanted to have Christy Alley return as Savick, not Robin Curtis, who had played Savick in the last two appearances in the film franchise. Kirstie Alley, who played Savick in Star Trek 2, and she wanted to do it. She wasn't available or something. Also, I think Nimoy is well documented as not having liked her performance, but which is why he recast her as Robin Curtis. But that's why they went with Samantha as our new Vulcan, Valeris, who was supposed to be Savick. And I'm pretty happy that they did that instead of using Savick and having her turn out to be evil, because that would have been a little bit of a bummer, having it be this other person, who is very much similar to, with the exception of a name change and no sideburns, like that, and her
she has visibly missing sideburns, like she has sideburn tan lines in this movie.
Yeah, and also her headband, which is weird, that was a good choice in terms of doing that. You had returning Brock Peters and John Chuck, who Brock Peters was the admiral who was shouting at screens in Star Trek IV when everything was crapping out on Earth, and John Chuck was the Klingon ambassador who was like, Kirk is a war criminal, like, try him in Star Trek IV. But they have their brief little moments here. You have appearances by Michael Dorn, who was Worf on Star Trek: The Next Generation, who makes a cameo as Colonel Worf, who is apparently the ancestor of the character he was actually playing on TV at the time. Weirdly,
he looked familiar.
Yeah,
or at least his voice was familiar.
Yeah. They have slightly different Klingon makeup in this movie than they have from everything else, and also Klingon wardrobing and costuming and stuff.
A lot of little tiny ponytails.
Yeah, and sort of making the brow ridges and stuff look more stretched and things instead of sort of the, I don't know how to describe it, but the just sort of like bonier looking stuff that they had in what Michael Westmore was doing on the TV shows at the time or in the previous movies. But the... you also have Rene Aubergenois, who would go on to be Odo in Star Trek Deep Space Nine. There was a whole plot line about Tim Russ, who is on Star Trek Voyager later, I think it was probably like 5 or 6 years after this movie was done. It must have been more than that, 7 years after this movie was done, where he was having flashbacks to being on the bridge of the Excelsior at the time of the filming of this movie. And if you want to see something that really looks like a TV movie, you can watch that episode of Star Trek Voyager, because they had to recreate the bridge of the Excelsior and all that other stuff for that one episode of a TV show. So it is a little dialed back from its appearance here, even further, which is, kind of disappointing. You know, Grace Lee Whitney, who was Yeoman Rand in the original series, but she's just the communications officer in the background. That was that blonde lady who was on the Excelsior.
Wait, was she the slightly older blonde lady who got a close-up where she nodded for a few seconds and then
yes.
cut away? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. wondering why, why are we lingering on this reaction shot of whoever this person is so long?
Yeah, I think that like in terms of fan service, I think that falls into that category.
Mm.
Because you just have like all this stuff in here where it seems like everybody's getting a little bit of something out of, you know, the deal of making this where people are kind of like trying to like, steer this into the last film to get this done. So it is a little bit of a different vibe than when you're doing Star Trek II, where you're at the start, the rebound of the franchise after the first movie.
The height of their powers.
Yeah, and now you've got something where everything's kind of like dwindling and everybody wants to, you know, just sort of put a finishing touch on it before they go out the door. So, you know, you gotta like write the ensemble cast that is Star Trek. You have to write something for everybody to do. and sometimes it seems pretty clunky, and they have some stuff that seems pretty superfluous or extraneous, or they're, you know, walking into and out of scenes that don't seem to make any sense for why they would be there. That is very much the case in this movie, where sometimes you're just like, why didn't you just call him? You didn't need to like walk over there. Why is McCoy performing surgery on a torpedo? Because it's fun. It's fun to listen to him like moan and, you know, kvetch about doing it. It's nice to have him be upset about things, but in terms of like the logic of this universe, it doesn't make any sense. Why are they the people who beam down to Kittimer at the end of the movie so that they can stop the bad guys from doing the assassination? Like, if they fall over, they're going to break a hip.
The old guy veterans, they're the best ones to do a dive in front of a laser blast.
Yeah, no, you would send down those football linebacker extras that they put the silly security armor on for that one scene where they vaporize a pot. Like, you would have those guys go down. Like, why would you just have a bunch of geriatrics just stumbling around on your set?
Well, they all have to be in the room to get the round of applause at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there you go. That's like everybody wants to have their little flourish, their little going out moment for this.
I did appreciate also that when the assassin in the end scene there was shot and flew through the window, he conveniently landed on his back with his rifle laying right next to him so everyone could see that he was an assassin.
Yeah, also, if you're paying close attention, which I know you weren't, his blood is human-colored blood, not Klingon-colored blood.
See, it's a triple cross.
Yeah, there's a director's cut of this movie where Nicholas Meyer restored the turns out where that is actually Colonel West, Rene Aubergenois' character from one brief scene earlier where they're presenting that, you know, rescue mission that they're going to go do to the president. Colonel Worf pulls off this rubber mask that's on Rene Aubergenois and reveals that it's Rene Aubergenois as Colonel West.
Wait, is that the guy who very specific, he was very suspicious and got a close-up saying, "I don't know what to believe, sir," and then the camera hung up.
No, that was the Romulan ambassador.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that guy seemed like he was up to no good also.
Yes, well, he wasn't up to any good at all.
This guy's face looks familiar, Rene.
Yeah, Rene Aubergenois. You've seen him in other things. He played Odo on Star Trek Deep Space Nine, but which was many years after this movie, but he's a pretty famous voice actor. He doesn't really talk enough for you to recognize that here.
An amazing photo of him in Police Academy 5, Assignment Miami Beach.
I have not seen that movie. Surprising no one.
He's got a really good look. I gotta send this to you. Wait, why can't I copy the... whatever. I'll try and send this to you.
Mm-hmm. Just to round out casting, which we talked about as part of this, you know, people wanting to have a flirt. Oh my God, what is that?
1988, baby.
What is that mustache, Renee? What are you doing?
It's a good look. To be honest, I think I had hair combed like that when it was 1988 for me as well.
Just like boy. Shellacked back and then just like a little caterpillar mustache.
I couldn't do the caterpillar mustache.
Mm-hmm.
He could be an uncle of mine. I mean, not with that glare or whatever. He'd have to smile, but you know. Mm-hmm.
And just to round out the casting stuff, since we were talking about it, you had Amon as sure, Martia, who was the shape shifting alien, and you would recognize Amon as being the wife of David Bowie.
You would be wrong that I would recognize her for that, but
she's also a famous model and actress from other roles. Yeah, but
my wife would recognize her for that, and then reminded me.
And that role was originally they had imagined having Sigourney Weaver for that role, but that would have been played a little differently, I think.
Is that right? Why would Sigourney Weaver be in this?
I don't know. Well, she went on to do Galaxy Quest, which, you know, was a better decision, I think, probably. But you had David Warner returning, who was Chancellor Gorkon, who they intentionally gave the weird Abraham Lincoln beard to, because they were like, oh, let's make him look like Abraham Lincoln. But he was the human ambassador in Star Trek V. And so in two Star Trek movies back to back, he plays a character with significant dialogue who is not himself. And then he would go on to, I think like a year after this, play some Cardassian on a Star Trek The Next Generation episode, the one where Captain Picard yells about the lights, the four lights. You've seen the Twitter meme. So you are well-versed in that already, I know.
What lights?
Yeah, there are four lights.
What? Where?
It's just their lights.
You mean like an it? Like the lights that come out of the...
Just look up on like Know Your Mem or whatever. We will not dwell on it. But so David Warner's Gorkon character was originally supposed to be Jack Palance, that didn't work out, and they got David Warner, and because Nicholas Meyer likes David Warner because they had worked together on Time After Time, and so he's here even though he would have already played a different person in something else prior to this. But it's the beauty of putting somebody in makeup, so they can disappear into a role and sound exactly like the other character that they were, because it's the voice of David Warner, which is very distinctive.
He did sound familiar, but I didn't recognize him, and I even clicked on him on IMDb, and I'm like, why would I know this guy?
Yeah, he's pretty recognizable, but it's okay.
Titanic.
Brock Peters, who plays Admiral Cartwright, he does it in Star Trek IV and Star Trek VI. He goes on to play the father of the main character of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, who is completely unrelated to Admiral Cartwright, just so happens to be played by Brock Peters as a human in both roles. So these things happen in the Star Trek universe, where you have these casting things.
That's great, man.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad everyone's working and stuff. did we neglect to talk about Christopher Plummer?
No, I was saving that for last because.
Okay. Well, you can't save for very last. Did you say Kurtwood Smith? You got.
Oh yeah, no. Kurtwood Smith, I neglected. Yeah, he's here. And as I mentioned in a previous movie where Kurtwood Smith has appeared, he has a big role on a 2-part episode of Star Trek Voyager, which he plays a different alien. But in this one, he is the president of the United Federation of Planets, and
he's
has
a hell of a look going on in this movie.
He's a big old mane of white poofy hair and feathered white poofy hair and a weird white Fu Manchu thing going on.
Yeah, he looks like something straight out of Flash Gordon or like some sort of 70s movie that would be made fun of on what's that show? There's a number in the name where the people make fun of old movies. Oh, God.
Okay.
Never mind. I'm tired.
Mystery Science
Mystery
Theater 3000.
Mystery Science Theater 3000. Okay. There you go. You know what I'm talking about.
A number in the name.
Yeah.
Who am I forgetting in terms of the casting, the significant casting? Kurtwood Smith, and then we can close this one out with Christopher Plummer now. So I played my Christopher Plummer card because he died unfortunately a little while ago. He you know, he was not young and spry by this point in his career. But he lived 91 years. So great for him. He was in an amazing movie a year before he died, which was Knives Out, which is not something that everyone can say. And he had a significant role in Star Trek VI, which I always liked. And I find his weird character to be very fun to quote. I like how much he seems to relish the performance that he is giving in these scenes, because he just gets to munch on some scenery. He has that strange mid-Atlantic quasi-British accent, even though he's from Toronto. He had acted with William Shatner before in like the 60s, I think, or 50s and 60s on a Canadian television. Like he's an interesting choice to go with, and I think that he really makes the movie and makes the role work, because he's a big old jerk who does all this big old jerk stuff. But at first you think he's just kind of mean, and then you realize that, oh, he's, you know, the guy who orchestrated all the evil, horrible stuff, because he's evil and horrible. But then he just gets to chew all the scenery till the end of the film. And then his final line is "to be or not to be" before a torpedo blows him to bits. Which, I mean, like, what? Who else gets to have that much fun doing this stuff?
I don't have an answer for that. I will agree that he's very big, silly Shakespearean and enjoying himself. Unlike Shatner, who was big in a different direction, I feel like Christopher Plummer did not so much disappear into this Klingon role the bigger he got with some of this stuff. You know, especially during the trial when he was kind of smirking and things. He just seemed like Christopher Plummer with some Tanner on and an eye patch. But maybe that's just me watching this with my eyes.
There is a significant amount of complexion change going on, which it's not like it was in 1960s Star Trek, where they were heavily in a complexion that was not their own. But he's got a very tan look, tan leathery look, kind of looks like a old baseball glove.
Yes. I mean, maybe the thing is when he does that little Christopher Plummer smile, there's nobody else that does that, so it just looks like him.
Yeah, well, he only sort of like smiles with one corner of his mouth. He has that, like I said, mid-Atlantic way of speaking where he's, you know, yelling and he's like, ah, flaunted the chain of command whenever it suited him. And it's just like, yeah, of course, like, you're Christopher Plummer. Like, you're not, you know, really that Klingon-y Klingon. Like, you contrast that with Michael Dorn's Worf in the same scene. They're not the same at all in terms of their acting. It works in this movie, I feel like, because he's supposed to be sort of an upper class, higher up, you know, jerky face. So he gets to be a little bit more refined, I guess, than most of the other lower ranked villains.
Okay. Well, okay. So since you brought that up, let's take that path for a moment and talk about the refined Klingon, because part of this thing is
the refined Klingon is my scene
for the refined Klingon in your life. Yeah. They do this whole like awkward dinner where they're like, ah, we're enemies, but now we got to be friends and stuff. And let's share toast and stuff. They're complaining about like how Earth is unintentionally racist, especially towards Klingons, and like this is going to be the eradication of their culture, which is more sort of primalistic and warrior based and less refined and just kind of, you know, we're weird, we eat with our hands and just shove food in our mouth and we make grunty noises and whatever. But Christopher Plummer's refined Klingon kind of flies in the face of that. And a lot of it also makes it harder for me to get into that when the Klingons are, you know, they're wearing shoulder pads and they're slightly tanner versions of humans. And like, you know, there's close ups and it's like, oh, you look, I can see your incredibly human fingernails on that guy's shoulder right there. So like some of that stuff, just like, they're like, ah, we're very different and you don't respect our culture, but also we're exactly the same as humans. And we're just, you know, slightly different. And we're talking about Shakespeare the whole time too. Like it seems like there's like 85-90% shared culture, and they're like, you're gonna erase our very different culture from Earthlings. And it's like, well, I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
Dan, I don't know how to break this to you, but we live in an America that is occupied by other people in this very same America who we share many things with, but who feel like we are going to exterminate their way of life by having our liberal ideas forced down their throats. And that they will be forced to conform and will lose their freedoms to be the people that they are.
I agree. I think that's too much nuance for this movie and for Klingons. I think they need to be. They're so human-like in almost all ways. They're like, except but, no, just shove some food in your mouth and wear shoulder pads.
But see, that's kind of this allegory that's going on here, because this is an allegory to the Cold War. You have the Klingon moon of Praxis exploding at the beginning of the movie, which is supposed to be an allegory for Chernobyl exploding and sort of signaling the unwinding of the Soviet bloc, because they could not keep being this militarized and also do what they needed to do financially. They were going to bankrupt themselves. They very directly say that in this movie, that the Klingons are going to bankrupt themselves unless we, you know, start dismantling all the stuff and we go towards a more peaceful solution. And you have a lot of those arguments about how, well, you can't make friends with the enemy because they're the enemy, and then they're going to ruin everything. And you can say all those horrible racist things, like they had Brock Peters do as Admiral Cartwright. Even though Brock Peters himself as the actor could not really do it in one take, because he found it so repugnant to say all that stuff, is because it is this allegory about how these people who are not so different from us are being treated very differently because they're not exactly the same, and that underneath all that latex and spirit gum, we're really not so different, you and I. And
the problem I had was that it was the other way around. It was the Klingon saying, we're super different from you guys and you don't accept us, and the Starfleet guys begrudgingly going like, no, we'll give it a try, you know, let's have dinner and stuff, and then they're the same still.
Yeah, but I mean, but you look at, like, let's say some right-wing people who are like, yeah, we are totally different. We are 100% on a different playing field. And they have iPhones. They have, you know, all the same stuff we have. They do all the same things we do. They go on Instagram like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm saying is, like, it's not, because it's allegory, it's not about how weird they are as aliens. That would not really be the point. Like, if you had them sitting at a table with xenomorphs, and it's like, yeah, we're here to make peace with you. And then, you know, the xenomorph's like, let me quote some Shakespeare or something. Like, that wouldn't...
Well, they wouldn't do Shakespeare. They would have to do, you know, Promethean culture quotes. I get what you're saying. It's still a movie, though, and it didn't draw me in. Not that it was ever going to, whatever. But like,
I think perhaps... there is nothing that a Star Trek movie could do to draw you in at all.
You know, if there was some Beastie Boys and some action and stuff, maybe.
you were not drawn into the JJ Star Treks. Don't try to pretend.
I watch them on TV from time to time, and they're still pretty entertaining.
Just like you walk into a room and it's playing on TV, and then you sit down and you're like, oh yeah.
Oh yeah, Chris Pine is doing the stuff here. And then, mm-hmm. you know... Spock gets all mad because they, you know, they beam on board at light speed and stuff.
Mm.
Whatever, warp. You know the words. You know the thing I'm saying.
Yeah.
Can I get a towel? I'd rather not take sides. You know that whole bit there.
Yeah. Well, but I don't know. I feel like it's a. I feel like it's a.
Does it really represent what you were feeling personally during the Cold War?
No, because I was a kid. so it didn't, that part didn't matter. But I'm just saying, you could see what the, like, it's not nuanced. It's not really, like, subtle. It's pretty ham-fisted with what it's doing in terms of, like, these are people that should be able to get along, so we're going to make them get along now. And that being, you know, apart and warlike is bad and doesn't accomplish anything.
Yeah, I mean, that's like kind of the overarching thesis for Star Trek in general, isn't it?
Basically, is, you know, they're all morality plays, basically, the old series anyway, where it'd be like, we're going to go to some planet, and they'll be like, well, what is the ethics of this thing? And they would portray that sometimes by having the Federation guys, like Kirk and his crew, show up and be like, no, you guys can't do this stuff because it's wrong. And that thing that would be wrong would be something we would be doing right now in our very own time on Earth. And it'd be like, we've grown past that because we're so evolved in our ways and thinking. Yeah. And then he'd blow up their computer or something. Like, it's just the way that they would do stuff is just sort of be like, this is the ethics and the morality of the thing.
Yeah.
And it's not so much like, we're going to show you the weirdest alien you've ever seen in your entire life. We're going to have the biggest space battle you've ever seen in your entire life. Like, that part of the drama isn't really there. It's not, Star Trek is not at its best when it comes to spectacle. Like, cause I said, cause of the budget stuff, like, you can't, what spectacle are you going to do?
You're going to have throw a styrofoam rock at a Gorn.
Yeah, and then you have like a bunch of people with their little metal detectors. They go walk around and they hit some other guy with a metal detector. Like, it's not gonna be that intriguing for people.
Yeah, and I guess throughout the entire series, they've been able to bring peace to the universe and all the people that they've met, except for this one race of folks, the Klingons, who basically just said, "You stay on your side of the universe, and we'll stay on our side, and don't ever come over here."
Yeah, because they had a contentious relationship.
Is there a reason for that? Or just they're like, we're too different. Get out of here.
Well, they're the stand-ins for the Soviet Union. And the Romulans were the stand-ins for China. That's how they sort of did it in the 60s. They had episodes that were about, you know, coming to a truce or being peaceful with Klingons. Not actual, like, outright peace forever kind of a situation, but those were the sorts of things where it'd be a sort of a commentary on relations with the Soviet Union, and likewise with the Romulans, it'd be sort of like as if it was China.
There was always a Soviet Union and China in the shows and movies, because there was at that time always a Soviet Union and China.
Yes, and by the time that this Star Trek VI movie, you know, The Undiscovered Country was coming out, there was no more Soviet Union. So how do you write the Star Trek version of that, of the Soviet Union going away? And in the TV show, like, Pavel Chekhov is Russian. That, you know, of course, Walter Koenig is not, he doesn't really talk like that, as we've mentioned, perhaps in the past. And that was its own commentary on Cold War, that they would go past that eventually on Earth, you know?
Nuclear vessels.
Yeah, nuclear vessels. They're across the bay and I'll meet up. But it's its own kind of, like, commentary by doing that sort of a thing. And so you have this movie where you're like, well, the actual Soviet Union has gone away. So what if we did the thing of, like, the bad guys who stood in for the Soviet Union? What if they were our buddies now? And Star Trek The Next Generation on TV, because it takes place, I think, a century or half a century after the events here, that they could do that. They could show when that peace actually happened, because they were at peace in Star Trek The Next Generation. Worf is a Klingon character on the crew, and they have a treaty with the Klingons, and everything's fine. There are some flare-ups, and, you know, there are asterisks by that, but it is...
Do they address the whole, like, your energy mining planet blew up and you don't have much ozone? Do they just go like, we'll give you some Earth technology that'll fix all that for you?
No, they never mention that again. Because that didn't happen yet on the TV show. But also, even in the stuff that happened afterwards, they had really no reason to dredge that up, because they talk about the evacuation of Kronos in the movie here at the end, the Federation president, one of his lines in his little speech that he's giving that we keep cutting to. He talks about the total evacuation of Kronos.
Right, because they're moving them to they're gifting them some new planets or something, right?
Well, they're just gonna move them somewhere else that's not contaminated by the explosion. They don't do that on the TV series or other movies or anything. So I'm just assuming that they will never. No one's ever going to really address that part, and that's fine. Just like how with the blood, It doesn't look like this in any other media that you've seen with Klingons. It's just this movie where it's this pinkish Pepto-Bismol thing.
A little purpley.
Yeah, a little pink-purple.
It kind of reminded me of, you remember when they were doing that purple ketchup in the 90s?
No.
Yeah, purple ketchup? You don't remember the crazy colored ketchups?
I know, I just remember the green one.
Purple.
There was a green one, right? Am I misremembering ketchup. That?
Nope, you're right. There was purple and green. Those were the two colors.
Okay. I remember the green one. But I forgot about
Easy Squirt.
I remember.
Oh, God.
I remember that branding. E, capital Z, and then Squirt. Yeah.
Look at this purple ketchup on these fries. That is just like the least appetizing thing I've ever seen.
Oh, no one wants to eat that.
It looks like a Klingon blood all over your fries. From Star Trek VI.
Well, I think this is too much of a. I think this is too violet. I think it needs a little bit more of that pinkiness to it. To really be Star Trek VI.
It needs a little less ray tracing and a little more whatever the hell they were using in 1991.
Fong.
Yeah, I guess it was pretty fongy, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's very fong.
And they put it right up in front of the camera. They're like, look at our distortions here. Look at our modifiers. We're stretching these things.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was the early 90s. 1991 is when this movie came out, so they were doing these effects in 1990, probably.
Oh, how do we go this whole time? You talked about the entire cast, and you didn't mention what you've mentioned in all of the other episodes where we've referenced this movie, that Christian Slater was here.
Oh, yeah, that was... It was another angle I was trying to use on you before a few weeks ago when we talked about those Christian Slater movies. I was trying to like finagle you into doing it because of Christian Slater, because Mary Jo Slater is the casting director of this film. She gave her son a cameo where he delivers some bad news to Sulu when he's asleep with his blue light his room.
At least they staged it correctly, so Christian Slater always tilting his head towards the ground kind of worked because Sulu was laying in bed.
Yes. But it was so funny to me how immediately recognizable it is as Christian Slater. And in this teeny tiny little role where you're just like, why are you in here?
He's in silhouette for the first half of it too, but you're like, that's Christian Slater. Why is he here?
Yeah, cause, I mean, talk about not disappearing into a role. As we've talked about before in our other Christian Slater movies we've talked about, he just is himself. And he talks like that. And that's all you got, really.
I would love to see some more Excelsior content that included Christian Slater.
Well, I'm sure there's a comic book tie-in or something that you could go read.
No, I need to see actual Christian Slater play it against George Takei. that would be a hell of a dynamic.
I told you I saw George Takei once, right?
Remind me.
Yeah, we were going to go fly to, I think it was Hawaii, I don't remember. But Jason is a United whatever class tier thing. So we were in the lounge at LAX, and then in the lounge at LAX I saw this little old man walking around, just shuffling back and forth with some papers and things. And he was sitting down next to this other old man, too. And I recognized them both as being George Takei and his husband. And I was like, oh, he's over there. And then I proceeded to just sort of stare at them awkwardly from a distance. But they didn't care because they were reading a newspaper, so it was fine. And I didn't want to go up and bother them, of course. But you did. I stayed the hell away. Afterwards, I had mentioned this to some people, and they're like, "No, you really should have just gone up and said hi, because George Takei apparently loves when people say they really appreciate his work and stuff." And I was like, "Oh well, missed opportunity, I guess. But I don't see the need. Don't see the need to push myself into someone's, you know, personal life while they're just trying to sit there and read their newspaper.
You could have heard him say the "oh my" thing in that voice.
Oh my.
that's the one.
Mm-hmm. Hikaru Sulu commanding. Captain
Slug. You've never run into Christian Slater at a airport lounge?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Yeah.
But maybe he wasn't talking, so I didn't recognize him at first. Just needed to stand in the corner and just, you know, talk a little. And then I probably would have been like, oh, wow, it's you, staring at the floor.
Have we ever determined where Christian Slater is from to determine why he speaks that way?
No, I have no idea. Never investigated it in my life.
I want to say he is from Sacramento.
I think he's from Southern California somewhere.
Yeah, I feel like he's like somewhere in between Southern and Northern. Oh my God, he's from New York. What part? There's no way. You did not like, grow up in New York.
Like upstate? Like New York? You're not in New York City.
Born in New York City. Wow. Okay. I guess I'm looking for the part where it says like he moved to Laguna Beach when he was 8 years old or something.
Hmm.
Yeah. No. It just says New York.
Okay. No, maybe he talks like that because he's trying to cover up his thick New York accent. I don't know.
Yeah. I think that might be giving him too much credit.
Yeah, it's probably giving him way too much credit. But he's here. He's present in the film. Yeah.
And accounted for.
It's an incredibly vital role for him. But, you know, it's how you sort of string out that whole thing of like Sulu being at the beginning and at the end, and he has the location for the thing and he's there to fight alongside his buddies.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's what they do. But
he targets the ship that comes out of the cloak with the exhaust seeking torpedo or whatever.
Yeah, he targets that explosion of fire. Did you like when William Shatner hopped up onto that thing with one leg and said fire and like clenched his fist
the first time? That was my God, so dramatic. It was kind of impressive how hard he was going for that.
Yeah, I'm surprised he didn't give himself a hernia from that.
that was like Khan level of screaming, or just the face he was making where he's like gritting his teeth, but also his mouth is open. I don't know how to describe it. Like his jaw is just like solid.
Yeah. Yep. So do you have any like questions about the movie?
Are you sad that this was the last one? Like that this was like the riding off into the sunset for the original folks?
Well, first of all, they literally ride off into the sunset. On this, they just dissolve into the sun at the very end. But I am not sad.
What was the last shot? Well, I don't even remember what the last shot was.
He says, you know, this is going to be a new crew.
Oh, right.
And
they take the ship into the sun.
Yeah, and then it dissolves into the bright sun because it doesn't actually erode around the ship like it sort of would. But anyway, I'm not sad that this is the last one. I'm happy this is the last one because I feel like this is a much better way to go out than Star Trek V, because that wasn't really an ending to anything, and it was really bad. So it's better to end on this one than, I think, in my personal opinion. And this is why 2, 4, and 6, I think, are good movies, and you know, 3 is okay.
Which one was 3?
3 is the search for Spock. That's the one where they go to the Genesis planet, which is a set. And they're there on that very fake looking set, for most of the movie. And Christopher Lloyd is a Klingon. And John Larroquette is a Klingon. You don't. How do you not remember that?
I don't know. People in Klingon makeup, they just look like Klingons. I don't.
But he sounds like Christopher Lloyd, and John Larroquette sounds like John Larroquette.
I don't know. Maybe I'm just. I picturing John Larroquette now. I don't know.
All
is
right.
Is that the one where they're in the cave with the lady, and he discovers he has the blonde son?
No, that's Star Trek II.
Okay, well then,
three is where the blonde son gets killed.
Okay, how does the blonde son get killed?
The Klingons kill him.
Well, yeah, but like how?
He gets shot.
Okay, he gets shot by Klingon.
Oh no, not shot. It was this stabbing with the knife thing over the back.
Okay, sure. I don't remember
the knife with the little blades. So anyway, this is a much better way to go out. And I know that you don't love this movie, but this is, I would say, a fan favorite for many people. Because...
And these people, do they like it? Do they think the plot holds up? The plot makes sense?
I think the plot makes sense. I'm sort of confused, because you seem to think the plot is too convoluted, or doesn't make any sense, or is too much like TV.
I don't understand anyone's motivation. Their planet's falling apart. And they need a new place to live, but they want to sabotage the whole, like, plan to create peace so they can go live somewhere where they're not going to die.
Yeah, so they want to take the stuff that they would need by force to have a military solution to their problems.
I understand why the Federation guys would want to sabotage this whole thing, but I don't understand why the Federation guys are in cahoots with Christopher Plummer to sabotage the whole thing.
Because it's in their best interest to cancel this out as well. And each of them thinks once the peace process is derailed, that they can go back to doing whatever it is, and then may the victor, to the victor go the spoils. But first they got to overcome the fact that there is going to be a peace process, which would be bad for both of them. The enemy of my peace is my friend.
Yeah. All right. I guess, sure, but then also there's a never before seen secret prototype, invisible bird of prey and stuff.
Yeah,
sure.
It's a prototype.
Yeah,
that's how prototypes work.
Yeah.
You don't build 47 prototypes.
I guess they weren't, the failing Soviet Union in that regard. Like, their technology was still going all right. They were just, not so good with the ozone layer stuff.
It wasn't an inflatable bird of prey. One reason the Bird of Prey is used again is because it is a very popular ship, and they already had it. And they love to use it a lot.
And the Bird of Prey is the invisible one, but the bigger other one was not a Bird of Prey.
Correct.
It's just kind of generally shaped the same way, but it's something else.
Yes, that is a Klingon battlecruiser. In the original series, it was a D7, but then they put all that greebly panel-y stuff all over the outside of it for Star Trek The Motion Picture, and it became the Katinga class. K-apostrophe-T-I-N-G-A.
I like those tacos.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of what would have made me believe the actions of the people in the movie, but I don't know that. I have much enough investment in the universe and the politics between the countries, the planets, whatever species is to really understand the motivations of such.
Well, to zoom in a little, maybe then, what did you think of Valeris?
Who's that?
That was Kim Cattrall's character, Samantha.
Oh,
evil Samantha.
So she's Spock's protege, who's supposed to be learning stuff from him, but also, I mean, where did she get her inclination to betray everyone? Was that just like listening to Kirk going like, well, Kirk doesn't like these guys, and maybe he's right instead?
Well, I think she got her inclination from Brock Peters. I don't think that she just showed up at his door and overheard him and said, now's my time to.
Yeah, okay, but like, why is she listening to Brock Peters instead of Spock? Like, when they're supposed to be buddy-buddy Vulcans.
Well, like she says, she believes that if they go through this peace process, that it's going to be a disaster. So it's in her best interest and the Federation's best interest, as she has decided, to sabotage that peace process. So she's committed to what she thinks is going to be the greater good of doing that.
The young trainee thinks she knows how like UN peace talks are going to go better than everybody else. So she's like, wow, this is clearly a bad idea. We'll just betray everyone now.
Yeah, I mean, young people can be a little ambitious and lack wisdom on things. So, you know.
I guess this guy was basically looking at her like she was wearing a trainee badge and she's supposed to just be following along with the old guys and like learning from them. But she feels as though she has enough agency in her position to sort of say like, no, I'm going to sabotage the entire universe.
Well, it's not just her operating by herself, but
yeah, she's you know, boots on the ground running the operation. So she's really invested. She's got to coordinate. She's got to kill the guys in the room with the boots and the suits and stuff. And then she's got to cover all that up. And so she's really spearheading this whole thing here.
Yeah. And you're not going to, but if one were to watch the movie again, you can find it more rewarding to see how they lay down the little breadcrumbs for this stuff for Valeris, because there's this stuff when the torpedo hit and it initially happens where she's typing away at a keyboard and they have a reaction shot from Uhura looking at what Valeris is typing and then glancing away because of all of the stuff that's going on. And then that's when the database entry is changed for the torpedoes. And then you have the stuff with Burke and Sandow where after the dinner scene, before the dinner scene, when the Klingons
she's like, you guys got work to do, stop being so lazy and sass mouthing and get back to your job. But she's really telling them to go kill the other guys.
Yeah. And when she shows up at Kirk's door, it's because she was listening on the outside of the door the whole time. So they set up these things, these clues, and like when she says to Spock later, like, oh, I tried to tell you, you know, tried to persuade you and you weren't listening. And he's like, well, neither of us were listening. And sure enough, in that scene, if you watch it, she starts to try to tell him that that she has this sort of feeling about the stuff. Like we've reached a tipping point in the affairs of the Federation and stuff. So she backs away from actually fully spilling the beans on that, but they did try to put that in there. And then in terms of like rewatching, you also can see the number of times that there is that little like black Velcro thing on the back of Kirk's shoulder, which I don't know if you even picked up on because you were probably staring at the ceiling or the progress bar waiting for the movie to end. But when Kirk goes to leave, Spock puts his hand on Shatner's shoulder, and then when Shatner turns back around, there is a little Velcro thing there, and that is the Viridian patch that he talks about tracking Kirk with.
Yeah.
And every time you see his shoulder, you see Kirk's shoulder for the rest of the movie until he changes into a fresh uniform. He has that patch thing on the back shoulder. I don't know why the Klingons just didn't take it off, but whatever.
Assume that he knew it was there the whole time and he was okay with it?
Yeah, well, he says to McCoy that Spock put the patch on his back. And
yeah, when they're down on the snowy lands, but like
they're like one day of location shooting in Alaska on a glacier.
Yeah, but he knew right away, and he's like, aha, I see what you're doing. You're clever there.
Yeah, well, I don't know if he knew right away, but I think he figured out what was on the back of his jacket. But it, you know, it's weird that he left it there in exactly the same spot, because if you're gonna get like searched or something, maybe somebody would take the thing that's on your shoulder, or it might accidentally fall off. Who knows?
Yeah, there's places you can hide that.
Yeah, just stick it up your butt, Captain. But it's one of those things where you can sort of see how that stuff was set up. But the first watch through, you probably don't see those clues. And because someone like Christopher Plummer is playing General Chang so weirdly, you don't know necessarily that he is the big bad that he is, although you may suspect that he is dangerous to the characters. You may not suspect that he is.
He stands a little too close to Kirk's face when he first beams aboard. Yeah, you can tell he's got some stuff going on.
I so wanted to meet you, Captain.
You know, I when you describe all of these little bits and pieces that were occurring the whole time, if what's her name, Samantha, was able to pull this whole thing off the whole time, right under their noses, she seems to be more capable than basically anyone else on either of these ships at doing running missions and stuff. So, like, props to her, I guess, and boo on everyone else for, like, not really knowing what the hell's going on.
Yeah, I think she's also able to get away with a bit because she knows that she is not under as much scrutiny as some of these other characters are, and that she can cover up this stuff because she has such a great understanding of the technical aspects of things. So, like, she knew that the phasers would set off the alarm, but she knows that, you know, phaserons done at close range won't. And she knows that...
Yeah, that scene was a little bit like the end of Clue there.
Yeah. Well, what did you think of the scene where she chooses not to tell them, and then Spock has to do the Vulcan mind meld on her to try to extract that information from her? And it doesn't seem like the kind of thing you should do in front of a room full of people like that. It's a little weird.
He pokes her face a lot of times. You know, my familiarity with the mind meld is probably more from the movie where Nimoy does it to Chris Pine. You know, you put a couple fingers down and you just kind of like chill and relax there, rather than like, you're not really working the facial muscles trying to like extract everything. And then, you know, to the point that someone exclaims loudly in a room, involuntarily, I know that needed to drag that scene out and like add some increasing drama to it, but, that's not how I assumed that would have worked.
Yeah. Well, one thing about that scene, like I mentioned, the changes in the director's cut. Another change is that they had these like freeze frames of the characters as she says their names. So when she says Admiral Cartwright, they do like a freeze frame that pushes in on Brock Peters for a second, and then cuts back to her doing this. So mercifully, that's not in the theatrical version.
It probably would have helped people like me who don't know all the names super well.
Well, you don't know the names because you were purposefully being obtuse about paying attention to the movie.
No, there's a lot of silly names here, and also somebody was cooking in the beginning of this movie, and the dialogue was very quiet. So
okay.
I can only turn the volume up so loud before I'm asked to stop.
Mm-hmm. And how was the cooking?
Oh, the food was good.
Okay, what was it?
It was a pasta, and then some broccoli, and some, it was like ricotta on the pasta. I don't know. There was capers and stuff in the pasta, and that's always good. I don't remember. It was those little like half looking shell rolly guys. I don't know what they're called.
Rolly guys.
It was like picture a Taurus cut in half.
So half a donut?
Yeah, but pasta.
Macaroni? Elbow macaroni?
But like the width of a finger.
Oh, okay.
I forget which pasta that is. I could look it up in my app that sent me the food.
Okay, this is not important to this conversation, but you can go ahead. But only if you read it in the style of a Merlin Mann internet food company ad. But the... I feel like this movie is not that hard to follow along with. I think that the surprises that you can get is because if you don't know what you're looking for with that Velcro thing, or you don't quite get what the breadcrumbs are with the Valeris stuff, that you may.
I mean, I wouldn't say it was confusing or anything. I didn't necessarily understand why these groups of people were aligning with each other. And I guess it's just that chaos defeats organized peace talks or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's regatta pasta is what it says. Lumaca regatta pasta. So I think regatta is the thing.
All right.
Anyway.
You seem so defeated.
By the pasta or the Star Trek?
I don't know. Either one. You seem... It seems like making the pasta defeated you during the Star Trek, or...
It made the quieter scenes in the early part of the movie difficult to understand, but I don't want to throw anyone under the bus here because, you know, mm-hmm. there's a shared home and I appreciate the food that was cooked for us to consume. I don't know, man. Like, maybe I need like a Star Trek therapist or something that can help me understand why I have no connection to these movies and why they don't do anything for me on any sort of intellectual or emotional level. But at the same time, I don't want to like, you know, deny that of you because these are your baseball movies. And, I've got baseball movies that are my Star Treks or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's, I'm glad that you enjoy and appreciate all of this. I cannot get into these at all. I mean, a 1991 space movie also. It's just like, oh boy, that's, as you say, that's made out of wood painted gray.
Yeah, it is. There's only so much that a movie in 1991 was going to be able to do. And then this does less than that. So that's just kind of how it's going to be. Because like you got like those scenes with the zero gravity stuff. It's just like, well, these are all people on wires. Like it's not that convincing at all.
Do gravity boots make it into any of the other movies or shows?
In Star Trek First Contact, which is two movies from now, they use them to walk on the outside of the ship hull.
Okay, but is this the first edition of gravity boots?
I think this is the first time that it happened. Also, they're really not gravity boots. They're magnetic boots. But
well, Spock turns to the side very softly and says, gravity boots, eh?
Yeah, even though the line of dialogue in the preceding moment was magnetic boots. But it's a thing. I think you've also probably seen it as a trope in some other stuff, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely. I was just curious because I feel like, as unobservant as I am with most of these movies, I feel like I would have remembered that from a previous film or something, and I did not.
No, well, they don't do any zero gravity stuff for the most part in these, because again, on
this
wires.
Is expensive. Yeah, I think the other thing, while I'm just like recounting the things that did make an impact on me in this movie, there were a lot of like a lot of the stuff that you're describing here with this coordinated plans and the alignment and stuff, that's fairly clever. And then you've got a lot of very, as you know, Bob, dialogue in here too. Like when they're sentenced to life on the freezing planet or whatever, there's like a dolly move where like three characters in a row like turn toward the camera and go like, ah, might as well just shoot them where they stand. It would be better. Known throughout the entire galaxy as the worst place in the... It's like, oh my God. All right. Thank you for all of that information.
The Alien's Graveyard.
The Alien's Graveyard. Yes,
which,
of course.
This doesn't really make a lot of sense. The Alien's Graveyard.
They're being sentenced to life on a work camp planet or whatever. Like, I get it. It's not... You don't have to do all of that. And there were a few other scenes. I can't remember what the conversation was earlier in the movie where they're like, well, as you know, we're not allowed to do that. Or this is the way that's going to go. And it's like, yes, I do know that. It's like, okay. That's a way to communicate things to the audience. But it seems like the rest of the movie is in stark contrast to the very, as you know, Bob dialogue. I wonder if that was a note where they're like, this is too subtle. Please make it less subtle for at least some of the dumb people.
I don't know.
Anyway,
maybe.
Well, at least I understood that it was known as the Alien's Graveyard.
Yeah, this movie is too subtle and not subtle enough.
All at the same time. It is, you know, it really, it just goes to show the duality of man and mm-hmm. Klingons, and how they can both maybe for they can both live on the same land of contrasts.
Mm-hmm. As long as they eat blue food, off their weird plates.
Right, they had blue noodles and blue Romulan ale.
Yeah, it looked like blue squid too. The apparently Nicholas Meyer said that because they used like real food that had been dyed, that it would stink to the high heavens when they put it under those lights, for filming purposes. Apparently did not smell great, and just trying to shoot that stuff over and over and over again was very painful. And he said the dinner scene was probably one of the most difficult things to shoot in the entire movie.
Mm.
Just because you have all those characters there around a table, trying to deliver their dialogue on opposite ends of the table and repositioning and setting up the camera every single time.
I should have just had like 5 cameras and knock it out.
I guess. I don't know. It wasn't that big of a set. But, you know, they blew it up. Well, they blew up the part of the set that wasn't being used on Star Trek The Next Generation, which was the window wall, which was saved. Does not blow up in the film.
Still bugs me that they call it Romulan ale when it's supposed to be this, like, super whiskey. Alcoholic beverage or whatever it is. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically supposed to be a distilled spirit of some kind, but they call it Romulan ale for some weird reason, which doesn't make any sense.
I like to imagine it's from a planet where Powerade evolved into an alcohol.
I think you're thinking of Hypnotic.
Oh, God, Hypnotic.
With a Q.
I think they still sell that. I don't think I've ever tried it, but that was in all of the hip-hop videos in the early 2000s.
Yeah. And I don't know if you've ever had there are a lot of blue beverages that you can get, which are kind of like what is it called, the blue Hawaiian or the blue Hawaiian iced tea or something. They all have blue curacao in them.
A friend of mine who was briefly a bartender used to make, what did he call it was like a Long Island iced tea, but it was blue. It was like straight alcohol and it was very flavorful, and it would put your face down in a gutter.
Yeah, there was there's a
trash can. It was called a trash can.
Oh, the name of the drink.
Yep, exactly. Yes, that really helps. You would take this blue drink that was like it was entirely alcohol, and you would turn a Red Bull upside down inside of it, and then it would drain itself while you drank it. So you would be hyped while you also black out.
Disgusting. But you know, that was the style at the time, because everything like in terms of beverages was alcohol plus Red Bull, and then you know all the other energy drinks were like, no, we're just like Red Bull, here, have a you know, vodka Monster energy, and then you'd be like, no thank you, this tastes disgusting. Or Amp. Yeah. Remember Amp?
Ugh. I do remember Amp. And you know, for a while, like Red Bull was too expensive, and then they would go with Rockstar, which was Rockstar was good. The one with sugar, not the sugar free. That was horrifying. But then Monster came in and they were like, we're going to sponsor everyone and you're only allowed to sell Monster at your bar. And then Monster tastes horrible.
Yes.
Monster is very bad. You put that in anything and it just tastes like Monster and it's bad.
Yeah. Well, actually, now that I say that, I think Amp might be worse than Monster, but then it's Monster.
Amp is just Mountain Dew that causes you pain.
It's like it just feels like you have instant acid reflux from drinking it, which is similar to the experience of drinking Monster too.
Yeah, the vending machines at Intel sold Amp, and I think Monster, and I think the lesser of those evils was Amp. So I drank a couple of Amps when we were doing our late night whatever work.
Yeah, now everywhere you went in the early to mid 2000s, you couldn't throw a rock without hitting a vodka Red Bull or vodka sugar-free Red Bull. But back to the blue thing, there was a beverage at the Saddle Ranch bar on Sunset that I can't remember the name of.
Wait, I've been to that bar.
Yeah, but it's blue, and it just is one of those things, just like you said with the trash can, like whatever the name of it is, I feel like it's something, I feel like it has the F word in it somewhere. It will destroy you. And you won't know until you're destroyed, because it is so strong, but also so not strong tasting.
Yeah, it's like when somebody knows how to make a Long Island iced tea just right, where you're like, this is actually a pretty good taste and drink, and then you're three quarters of the way through and you're like, oh, I can't stand up out of this chair.
Man, it's been so long since I've had a Long Island iced tea,
not go over well.
No, I don't think I could tolerate that these days. But
that is a drink for 24-year-old people. But you have to explain to me why you were at the Saddle Ranch. That is not an image that I can really put into my mind easily.
I was there with some friends at the time.
Are they still your friends after that?
Well, not specifically. Not that wasn't really the problem. But no, we're not. I only went that one time.
Did you ride the bull?
I did not ride the bull. I do not partake in bull riding.
And bull riding. Did you guys get one of those, whatever they call it, the like 4 foot tall pillars of beer that you can pour yourself?
Oh, absolutely not. No. But yeah, the moral of the story is blue stuff is bad. Don't drink blue stuff. And that's basically what they did in the movie.
Oh, it's like flowers in nature that have evolved bright colors to sort of let animals know, don't drink this because it'll kill you.
Yeah, and it's not like the Curacao or the Hypnotic or whatever is naturally blue anyways. It's not like that comes from a specific kind of berry that is blue, because blueberries aren't even blue if you juice them. But
it's only Hypnotic if it comes from the Hypnotic region. Otherwise, it's just sparkling blue Curacao. Oh, I stole your joke. Sorry.
It's not my joke, but
You're a fan.
I'm a fan of the joke, yes. But yeah, I mean, speaking of, I wonder what the denomination restrictions are, the appellation restrictions are on Romulan ale. Like, does it have to be from Romulus to be called Romulan ale?
Oh, that's a good point. If it's bootleg bathtub earth made Romulan ale, is it still Romulan ale? It's like you can't call it bourbon if it didn't come from Kentucky, but a lot of people try.
Well, apparently you can't actually call it bourbon if it doesn't come from Kentucky.
I've noticed people doing this. Is this just being deregulated? Are people just, you know, namespace pollution on the bourbon brand? What's going on there?
No, apparently it is just a requirement about the mash bill. So you can call it bourbon even if it's made somewhere else. But there are requirements about Tennessee whiskey, however, where you cannot just use that one willy-nilly, even though Tennessee whiskey is not that different from bourbon.
Who calls Tennessee whiskey other than Jack Daniels?
I think it's mostly just Jack Daniels would be the one that people would know of.
Yeah, I thought that was like part of their brand.
Is Jim Beam Tennessee whiskey or bourbon? I forget. I just think it's bourbon.
Yeah.
Oh, God, Jim Beam tastes disgusting. But it's weird how Jim Beam owns everything if you really like look at the map of what they own.
There's Jimmy, I caught like half of it. There's terrible. A documentary on bourbon that I saw on, I don't know, some stupid channel. But yeah, they basically go through and talk about, you know, the three distilleries that own all, like the 12 different places that you can walk to in Kentucky, and how one of them burned down and how they all banded together and helped each other out and interviewed all these old timers about how they like to drink their whiskey and what's important and blah, blah, blah. It was very, you know, old world. This is how we do things.
I've watched like 10 minutes of several different bourbon documentaries, so I may have seen that one as well, but I always kind of like tune out by the first 10 minutes where I'm just like, oh wow, a lot of drone footage of stuff,
barns and things.
I don't know, what it is, if they're just like in film school for documentarians, they're just like, here's your drone.
You need a lot of establishing shots that you can show, like pretty looking stuff that you can show while you recut all of the dialogue to make some sort of semblance of a story, because there's not going to be one naturally.
No. Ugh. So ridiculous. And there's like a what's his name, Steve Zahn. He is like a bourbon thing. Tried to watch that, couldn't do it. And as you know, I like him very much from Saving Silverman. We should do Saving Silverman sometime. Oh,
God. I'd be curious to know if it holds up, but I feel like I'm going to cringe through the entire thing.
Oh, yeah. Especially the whole, like, Jack Black realizing that he's actually gay for Early Ermey.
Oh, shit. I forgot that was part of the story. And he falls in love with Early Ermey. Oh, no. Because the line I remember from Jack Black is, you know, if the nachos stick together, that's one nacho. Like, that's wisdom that you can take from that movie.
Every time I have nachos, I think about that line of dialogue. It's so dumb. I love
it. It's so bad. Yeah. The things that you carry forward with you for decades. Yeah. You know,
I went to Big Montana with curly fries.
There are like casual jokes from podcasts that have stayed with me for many, many years that I know aren't true. They're just like something somebody said, like as a half joke, but they're still there. And that one, and then, you know, Arlie Ermey, you know, pooping in the front yard and using the mail as toilet paper. Anyway. I was going to say, I saw, as you do, one of those like, tell me a thing about yourself trend thing. And it was like, what is one liquor that you can no longer drink? After like your 20s or whatever, and Jim Beam Rye is one of those that I had a night with in I don't know, end of high school, early college years that I can't drink anymore. I don't know if you have anything like that.
I didn't even know they made a Jim Beam Rye, but
you should never seek it out.
I wasn't planning on it. I basically, anytime I see Jim Beam as a, like a label anywhere, I'm like, nope. not gonna make that mistake. But what the thing that was a mistake for me was on my 22nd birthday, because you know I have a birthday in December. Mm-hmm. So on my 21st birthday, none of my college friends were actually old enough to do anything. And then on my 22nd birthday, we all went to a bar, and I had a lot of tequila. Not because everyone, you know, in your early 20s, on your birthday, everybody's like, let me buy you a drink. That doesn't scale very well.
Yeah.
And
did they do the thing where they try to get you to drink 21 shots?
No, nobody did that. But it might as well have been by the end of the evening, because every time someone buys you a drink, because they're trying to be nice, you're going to get destroyed, because you just can't have that much. So your 20s is really about learning how to politely decline on your birthday, to not have all of those things happen, because you will be destroyed. But the thing that was destroyed for me was tequila, because everything was there were several tequila shots, because one of my friends at the time in college, she really liked tequila shots, and like with the lime and the salt and all that.
Mm-hmm.
I was never really on board with that, but just the smell of tequila afterwards, like, immediately just turns my stomach. I'm better about it now, where I can have like a margarita or something, but like,
right,
I'm not going to do a tequila shot. You're not going to have that happen. That's impossible.
Yeah, there was a time where Jack Daniels was that for me as well. I remember towards the end of my run with Jack Daniels, I tilted my head back for a shot, and by the time my head came back to vertical, it was coming back out the other direction. But you know, you mix it with some Coke, and you're a little better off these days. But yeah, that's alcohol.
Yeah, and I don't know if this was popular when you were in college. I'm going to assume it probably was, because it was the same time, but you were in a different region. But there were those shots, like liquid cocaine and Four Horsemen.
The Four Horsemen featured heavily in my 21st birthday.
Sorry.
Quick story. I'll make this short. So I was blacked out by like 10:30. Not the least because of these frequent shots at Four Horsemen, etc., like that. But I thought I lost my wallet, and then the next morning I was stumbling around this like mostly outdoor bar, just obliterated, hungover, probably still drunk, trying to find my wallet on the ground, like in the grass. I had dropped it and kicked it underneath my bed all the way against the wall, which is where it actually was. But my friends actually did something very clever. I was incredibly drunk, and they're like, hey, can I borrow your phone? My battery died or whatever. And I was too drunk to know the difference. And they all pretended to take shots with me for whatever the like penultimate or ultimate shot was that put me out. And they all had shots of water that they dumped on my head. But he took my phone away so that I wouldn't get my phone wet. So I appreciated that.
It's very thoughtful.
And then I slept on a bar for an hour or two before they drove me home. And I'm pretty sure I vomited all of it into a tall trash can.
Hmm.
It was rough. It was a rough go.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like there are several lessons that one learns in their 20s that are important. And then when you're in your 30s, you're like, well, I can't have anything now like that. So glad I learned all those lessons. Yeah. Those important lessons.
Not particularly helpful.
Yeah. But here we have all these geriatric people just down in Romulan ale left and right. And then, you know, McCoy, he's just got to go find a pot of black coffee.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah, that'll help.
Apparently it gives you a wicked hangover. All right. Well, I think we have discovered our country, so to speak.
Sure.
Because now it's in our past.
Yeah.
And you don't have to watch the movie again. It won't make you.
Thank you. Appreciate that. I like that the Klingons also have a concept of countries. I'm glad that that's something universal, like language and things like that.
Well, you know, maybe there's something that's lost in the translation, but I have to assume that there are some units of political statehood or whatever on their planet at some point in the past that would be analogous to countries. Because Earth by this point has a, you know, global government. And so I would assume that the Klingons had some warring factions earlier on.
Mm.
So they would have had countries too, in a way, whatever they would call a country in the Klingon language, in the original Klingon.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Right. Universal translators, etc.
Yeah. Yeah. But are you going to go pick up the Klingon Hamlet? The entire Hamlet thing translated to Klingon?
That's not a thing, is it?
It's a thing. You can buy it. It was in bookstores in the mid-90s.
I don't want to read regular Hamlet.
So, you know, on that note, we're done.
End. I was saving for the end that I was trying my internet recommended beverage from the Mr. Sandwich's podcast while we spoke, and it was pretty tasty.
Oh, what beverage is this?
This is the Instagram purchasable. It's called House, HAUS.
Oh, yes. Ugh, House Aperitif. Ugh.
It's not bad. I liked it. Have you tried?
I haven't tried it. Their whole brand is smarmy. So I was turned off by it.
I mean, I listened to the podcast and they described it. And I was like, yeah, that sounds like something I would drink. And I ordered a little sampler pack where it's you get four different flavors in like little 200 milliliter bottles for $40 or something. I was like, sure, fine with me.
No. Yeah. I
hate to break it to you, but I think you would enjoy some of these.
It's like bad spiked wine with, you know, fruit flavors and stuff in it.
No. This one kind of tastes, it's very Manhattan-y, Negroni kind of, at least this bitter clove. Is that the one that I just drank? I don't remember what it is. It's tasty for a slightly lower alcohol beverage with some herbs and flavors and things.
Mm. Okay.
As Eric said, we didn't talk about the signatures. I don't want to talk about the signatures.
Yeah, well, we're going to sign off here at the end.
Oh, we're gonna sign the screen.
Yeah, we're signing the podcast right now. Dan, sign your name.
No, see that you're gonna steal my identity.
No, sign your name on this podcast, goddammit.
Only if you promise not to steal my identity.
I promise. I will not steal your identity. Now sign this podcast right now.
All right, I'm doing it right now.
Okay. And now I'm gonna sign my podcast because I get to do it last because I'm William Shatner in this scenario. And then we're done.
Yeah, I'm fine with you being Shatner in this dynamic. Does that make me Spock or do I get to be somebody else?
I don't know. Since you're over it, does that make you George Takei? I mean,
I'd be George Takei. I would be a McCoy as well. Hell, I would be probably more like a Chekhov. I'm just over in the corner just like, yeah, my hair looks really weird. Let me know if you need me for anything.